Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hello, this is the Redbox Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley, bringing you the best of my Times radio show. You can listen live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1, on your DAB radio, on your smart speaker, or download the Times radio app. Coming up on today's episode, it's the final part of The Political Editors. We began with Watergate, we end with Partygate. Stephen Swinford, current political editor, it's really good to chat with him. He really lifts the lid on some very recent political history. So that's coming up in just a moment. But first, as we always do, we take a look at the news with today's columnist panel.
The Columnists with Alan Burt, Alice Thompson and Robert Crampton on Times Radio.
Yes, Robert Crampton's here. Hello, Robert.
Hello.
And Alice Thompson's here. Hello, Alice.
Hi.
Where are you, Alice?
And I am in a shed, which I have been told to be in. So it may
to be clear, by the producer, not by your husband.
Who's not by my husband. I've been banished. I've been banished by the Times to a shed.
Yeah.
Which is quite, actually, thank God it's not raining here because this shed is quite leaky, but I do use it occasionally when I'm trying to get rid of the family.
So we are going to speak in a moment to the winner of Shed of the Year.
Archie, which
you're very excited about.
Yeah, well, I need some advice. I think.
I'm very excited. He put my story on his Instagram, apparently, according to my daughter.
Have you gone viral?
Yeah, my daughter follows him, and she checked it, and he's put...
Well,
yeah.
We'll come to that. That's what we call trailing ahead. That's the sort of content that our listeners are here for. First of all, let's talk about faith. Front page of the Times today, Britain isn't a Christian nation now, say clergy. It's amazing. It's a huge poll of priests in England. Britain can no longer be described as a Christian country. Three quarters of Church of England priests believe. Most wide-ranging poll of frontline Anglican clergy for a decade has found a desire for significant changes in teaching on sex, sexuality, marriage and the role of women to bring the church more into line with public opinion. What do you make of this, Alice? I don't know if you're a churchgoer. Are you surprised by this?
What I think is actually a great idea is we've asked the vicars finally what they think, because they haven't been asked for too long. And on issues like gay marriage, I think it's really important to know their views, because they're actually much more in line with the rest of the country than you'd think. And they do believe in gay marriage and they do want gay marriage in church, which I think is great. But I think it's just interesting to know where it's not always just what the archbishop or the bishops think. And particularly as I think it's going the other way in other places around the world, in places like Africa, where it's becoming more traditional and more anti-gay and more belligerent about women. It's good that you've got these vicars speaking out, to be honest.
Interestingly, we just had a message in from Reverend Dr. James Bruce. Mm-hmm. Says 75% of clergy surveyed think England isn't a Christian country. 53% think the solution is to make the church less Christian, to follow the country, mad as a box of frogs. And that was a striking thing, reading the detail of it, Robert. The suggestion that the solution for the church is to move essentially further away from the church's teaching on sex before marriage, gay marriage, the role of women. And it seems a weird sort of, I suppose it's the tension at the heart of the church.
It's very tricky because you're trying to sell a philosophy which most people don't agree with anymore. But if you water it down, what's left? You're just looking at a sort of kind of vaguely social democratic, be nice to people approach. I'm conflicted about this because I don't believe in God. I think it's... I mean, I go to church occasionally for weddings and funerals and memorial services and so forth. And I think it's, I like going, and it's a great place to go until they start talking about God, at which point I can't trade with it anymore.
Yeah.
But the ethics and the people, I've got friends who go to church, and they're, you know, they're really good people who do good things in the world. And I think that's true of the vast majority of vicars. So I don't want to see it necessarily decline. And also, I think it fulfills a major social function, especially in the countryside. So I don't want to see it decline in that way, but I think it's selling something which isn't true, I'm afraid, and that is the problem. So it gets itself into this terrible mix-up about, it has to revise its own teachings.
It's interesting, Alice, in the story today, there's a quote from the Bishop of Leeds, the Right Reverend Nick Baines. He says, on behalf of the Church of England, "The church is the church, and as such, not a club. It has a distinct vocation that does not include seeking popularity." Mm. Which I just thought was a really striking quote, because actually part of the job of the clergy is to presumably to grow the flock, to seek popularity, to bring more people in.
I think popularity is a weird word with religion, because it's not really about that. It's about faith, isn't it? It's not trying to make yourself more popular, you hope. But I kind of like what Robert's saying. It's vaguely democratic, and it's sort of rather wishy-washy and nice to people. And I don't think there's anything wrong in that. I think the Church of England was always more like that. I mean, it was based on such an odd premise anyway with Henry VIII. It's not like anyone was deeply passionate about religion at that stage. Mm. So I think in a way I rather like the fact that it's a social construct. That, you know, we go to church, you go at Christmas, you go at Easter if you do go. It brings people together, that you have the church faiths. I love all that stuff. I'm like Robert, I don't really believe in the religious side, but I do think it holds us together. And if they can act like that more, I think that they probably will get more people coming.
Yeah, I mean, it was based on a fudge, and it's preferable, perhaps, because this survey does not suggest that there's a decline in religion. It says there's a decline in Christianity. But if you look at Islam and Pentecostal churches, there's loads around where I live in Hackney, and I think they're probably more extreme on these sort of social issues, the cultural issues that we're talking about. They're actually growing. So there is a desire for religious attendance and belief. So it might be better for people to go to somewhere which is a bit fudgy and a bit liberal than somewhere which is hellfire and intolerant.
Yeah. And actually, one of the things, because I'm not religious, and one of the things that I've always found sort of interesting and surprising is, because in fact Wes Streeting came on the show and was talking about exactly this, he is a Christian, but he has big problems with the fact that he's also gay, and essentially his church doesn't welcome him because of that.
Well, I think it's a second class citizen. Yeah, exactly.
And those two, his sexuality and his religious beliefs collide.
Yeah.
But then I just don't, I personally struggle then with his religious belief.
Yeah. But that's what put me off, I think, the church, is I've got the same as, you know, my eldest son's gay, and the idea that three of my children can get married in a church if they want to, but he can't, just does seem extraordinary in this day and age. And then, stranger, having interviewed Richard Coles, who had to have secret weddings when he was a vicar for gay people, the idea that people have to creep into church to get married when you should be wanting to celebrate having people there who do feel religious, who do want to get married, who do want to have a committed relationship, seems completely bizarre.
Well, no, but the thing that I don't really understand is, if you are gay and then you're not welcome, I don't know why you would want to get married there.
No, I don't understand that either.
But that's how I suppose.
I think with someone like Richard Coles was really, you know, he does believe in God and he wanted to be accepted. And I think that makes it harder.
Yeah.
You're being rejected by the very people that you desperately, you know, want to accept.
He believes in a more forgiving, tolerant God, presumably.
Yeah.
And he thinks the church has got it wrong. I thought there was one really interesting quote from one priest who said, talking about the strain that vicars are under.
Yeah.
And usually people say, oh, they're not paid very well, or they're having to run loads of churches. He said, the pressure of justifying the Church of England's position to increasingly secular and sceptical audiences. I mean, that kind of says it all, really. Yeah, you're in a job, and people don't believe. They don't believe your fundamental offer.
Yeah. And the reason they're all having to share, do multiple churches, is not enough people are coming.
Yeah.
It's all part of the same problem.
Yes, yeah, I mean, I think it needs to move. I think insofar as it's a good thing, it's a social thing, and it needs to maybe move towards that. But that means taking God out of it, which is the raison d'etre. So.
But it's fascinating. And obviously there's a big, you know, in terms of the politics of the church, there's a big tension between the priests here who want to move to a more liberal position, and the tension that then creates with Anglican churches around the world, and particularly in Africa, where they're much more traditional.
Yes, and that's every Archbishop of Canterbury spends his stint keeping the whole thing together with increasingly
tricky
fudge.
Let's move on. It is fascinating. I'd recommend, whether you're religious or not, it's a really, really fascinating insight into one of our big sort of national institutions and its potential future. Well worth having a look at look online at that. Alice, your column today. You've performed a U-turn.
I know, it's always sort of nerve-wracking performing a U-turn because then everyone expects you to do on everything else. But Miss Snuffy, who is meant to be the strictest school teacher in the world, Catherine Birbal Singh, and she runs a school in Wembley in North London. And I'd always thought she was just too strict because they're not allowed to talk in the corridors and they get sort of marched off to the loos in breaks and they sit in silence quite often. They have to just put up their hands if they want to talk. But actually, she does get these phenomenal results, and it's not a selective school, but they were all getting eights and nines in their GCSEs, and then they all get A's, A stars, and their A levels. And the looks on these children's faces when they get those results, she's completely transformed their lives. So I do now think maybe it is worth it, you know, that strict discipline, you know, has given them a sort of different chance in life, that they will all be able to go on, they'll be able to get any apprenticeships or jobs, or, you know, some of them had sort of 10 nines at GCSE. And that's phenomenal. That's not matched by anywhere else almost in the country. And so I do think that she is doing something that's very interesting. We should be looking at it.
I'm slightly torn on it because there's part of me, she clearly gets results and she clearly is very passionate about it. The sort of slight foghorning on, particularly on social media about it and judging everyone else and every other school and parent, and it all becomes part of a sort, you know, of a sort of culture war again as to whether or not you're on Team Birbal Singh or not, rather than thinking there might be something in this.
Yeah, I didn't know that about social media. Yeah. She's kind of boastful.
She's quite active on there.
Right, fine. Well, I mean, I think, yeah, I'm conflicted as well. I think the pendulum in state education swung too far towards kind of creativity, so-called creativity, and lack of structure, and education suffered. It sounds to me like she's gone a bit far back the other way. If you can't talk in the corridors, that's part of being educated and growing up and sharing ideas. Being escorted to the loo, I don't like that. But in terms of saying, just because these kids are from relatively disadvantaged background doesn't mean they can't do really well at school, then that is great if she's taking that on and promoting ambition and widening people's horizons. And I liked the bit in Alice's column where she said she doesn't accept excuses for things and she promotes individual responsibility, because I think there's a tendency across society to avoid individual responsibility for things. And so if she's helping to bring up a cohort of kids who are saying, yeah, this is, you know, there are all these problems which are not of my making, but I can make my own way nonetheless, then that's a good thing.
Yeah.
More so than the exam results, in a way.
Well, it's interesting. And always good to hear a columnist admit they've changed their mind or something. Mm. Wouldn't catch me doing that.
No.
Robert was talking earlier on about mistaken identity, because, well, Wagner's coming up later. He's been mistaken for the mercenary group. You said you'd been mistaken for...
I think he's called... Jimenez. He's called Jimenez. Yeah, Jimenez. I can't remember his first name.
Well, Ashley's been in touch from Glasgow. Speaking of the Spanish golfer Jimenez, I once failed to recognise him while working in a Dundee restaurant when a student. I asked him what brought him here, to which he replied, the golf. I asked, was he watching? And he explained, no, he was currently leading the St Andrews Links Championship.
Yeah, that was actually me.
Might have had better luck recognising Robert. Yeah. Yeah. There we are. Very good. Right, now let's turn our attention to sheds. We are going to speak to the owner of the Shed of the Year, Archie Proudfoot. Archie, are you there?
I'm here.
Are you in your shed?
Sadly not, no. I'm away from shed this morning. I'm on holiday in Norfolk.
Oh, yeah. No, to be honest, if that was your... I can now see you. It's a very sort of posh bedstead there. It'd be very weird if that was in your shed. Archie, tell us what made your shed an award-winning shed?
I think what they really loved about my shed was the story of it coming back from the dead.
Yeah.
And I restored it from being a rotten husk that really should have been torn down and replaced. And the reason I didn't do that was because it was sort of the middle of the pandemic and timber prices had gone through the roof and I was bored. And I thought, you know what, let's give it a go, see if we can save it. And I brought it back, you know, using old recycled bits of timber and just the tools I had. And it was some of the most fun. It was the most fun I had during the pandemic. I was just in my garden hacking away at this old husk until it came back to life.
And Lazarus then, shed.
The Lazarus shed. And then yeah. once it was back from the dead and looked like it could survive again, I really sort of turned my skills as a professional artist to absolutely just covering it and enjoying myself in the most way possible to turn it into a sort of miniature Sistine Chapel of sheds.
But at what point have you patched it up, repaired it, replaced it to the extent that it's like
the knife with two new handles and one
Trigger's yeah. broom in Only Fools yeah. and Horses. Yeah. He's had it for a long time. He's had 10 handles and 5 brushes. Mm. At what point is there anything left of the original shed, Archie?
There's still quite a bit left of the original shed, but basically almost the entire floor was rotten. And so that was what made it particularly precarious. So when all of the rot of the floor was cut away, it looked like a game of Jenga that was about to collapse. Mm. Well, so, a strip of floor in the middle, and it was tottering.
Listeners have been getting in touch with their shed stories. David says, it sounds a bit like yours actually. At one point, the side of our shed had almost completely rotted away. I was helping some election candidates take their plastic posters, which were a thing in some places, including Northern Ireland, helping them take them down after the election so they wouldn't get fined for fly posting. My dad saw the posters and decided to rebuild the rotten wall out of planks and election posters. I was supposed to return the posters to the candidates, but I couldn't because they'd become part of the structure of the shed.
Excellent.
Brilliant.
What was it that you liked so much about this, Robert?
About Archie's shed?
Yeah.
I like the fact it was quite modest. I mean, it's very colourful and it's fantastic, but it looked like a natural shed, whereas a lot of the entrants in this competition, they actually look like sort of chalets or summer houses, or I mean, it's just people throwing money at them. And I think one guy was giving Archie a bit of hate on social media and because he wasn't sort of posh enough, I think.
Yeah, and I'm reading on Mail Online, disgruntled Shed of the Year contestants yeah. who spent thousands of pounds on their efforts have been left scratching their heads after a basic budget DIY shed triumphed in their place.
Well, it's a great, you know, man of the people story.
Yeah, because other people just spent thousands of pounds on it.
I wrote about it yesterday and got a lot of cred with my daughter because she follows Archie on Instagram and she saw that Archie had put my little thing up on his Instagram. So, thank you, mate.
Yeah,
no worries.
People are not happy. Alice, talk us through you're in your shed right now. Talk us through your shed.
Yeah, our shed has had various iterations, I have to say. It's been a Wendy house for quite a bit when they were little, and then it has been for chickens, and at the moment it's kind of tool shed, but I use it when I'm working if I try and get away from everyone. So
I like it. Cred shed.
It's fairly basic. Yeah, I was thinking of painting it, actually. I've seen Robert's column, I thought, actually, I may give it a go.
Our shed started leaking in February 2020.
Mm.
Unlike Archie, I'm not up to the job of... I'd patched it up as much as I could, but it needed replacing.
Mm.
So we took all the stuff out of it. The whole kitchen was full of lawnmowers and, you know, bikes and all that sort of stuff. And then we went into lockdown and we thought, we can't, however long we're in lockdown for, we can't live with the lawnmower.
No, so it forced you to do something.
So we had to put it all back. And so in the end, yes, yeah, so eventually it came back. But we just had a very basic shed built, just a bit too small as well.
I think a little leak is permissible in a shed. Yeah, in fact, it adds to kind of authenticity.
The smell, the damp.
Yeah.
Yeah, the spiders.
Exactly.
Archie, where do you think you draw the line between a shed and what is basically, as Robert was saying, a chalet and these people who are giving you grief online?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's effectively you can draw the line at insulation and like an airtight seal.
Yeah,
at that point, it becomes a garden building, which is a totally valid and a beautiful thing to have. And I considered actually tearing down that shed and building a garden building to be a kind of proper home studio. But I just couldn't really be bothered. I didn't want to spend money, frankly. And I wanted to have a bit of fun and working on a shed is fun because it's light-hearted. It's not like a building of that or a proper structure where you need to do things correctly. It needs to be everything level. It needs to be on point. If there's not a seal, all of that money and all of that effort is just going to go down straight.
It's got to be drafty.
It's got to be drafty.
And any source of heating has got to be a fire hazard.
Yeah, and mice need to be able to get in to eat some of what you can say.
Yeah.
Yeah, in fact, reading these quotes, shed enthusiast Alex Dodman spent 4 months and £2,000 building his Alps-style ski chalet.
Mm-hmm.
He told Mail Online, I was gutted to have lost, especially because I put blood, sweat and tears into building my shed. Mm. In my opinion, the winning shed was just a shed.
I think that's sour grapes. I mean, congratulations. Well done for putting your blood, sweat and tears and your $2,000 and your 4 months into your shed. And you've still got your shed, mate.
You've still got your shed.
Enjoy your shed.
Yeah.
Enjoy your shed.
I know. I also I just want to clarify, like, mine didn't happen overnight without a huge amount of blood, sweat and tears on my part.
Well, quite.
A lot went into that. A lot of hours and a lot of love and a lot of time. And I mean, I put money in mine. Like, there's a lot of gold in that shed. There's about £500 worth.
That's a very good point.
Archie's also
wasn't free.
Yeah. Archie's also got a great moustache.
Yeah, he's got a great moustache, which mauled you over as well.
There's blood, sweat and tears have gone into that moustache as well.
Alice Thompson and Robert Crampton there, and of course you can read them both in The Times every week. Just get yourself a subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox. Up next, part 7 of The Political Editors.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
You're listening to the Redbox Podcast. Now it's time for this.
The Big Thing on Times Radio.
I don't think that other people in the world would share the view that there is mounting chaos.
Where there is discord, may we bring harmony.
We're all right!
It is time to put up or shut up.
A new dawn has broken, has it not?
This is a decisive moment for the world economy.
Now the decision has been made to leave, we need to find the best way.
Nothing has changed. Nothing has changed.
I have been repeatedly assured that there was no party.
Growth, growth, and growth.
Some mistakes were made.
Since 1785, Times journalists have been writing the first draft of history. In our series, The Political Editors, we've reflected on half a century of politics with the people who had a front row seat. We began with Watergate and we end with Partygate. In part 7, current political editor Stephen Swinford on the political violence of 3 years with three prime ministers, Tories squaring up to each other, serene Liz Truss as her premiership blew up, and sacking Kwasi Kwarteng by tweet.
In the 2.5 years that I've been political editor, we've had three prime ministers, at least 42 ministerial resignations, and literally they physically squared up to each other in the garden. The violence, the political violence, nearly ended in fisticuffs. Kwasi Kwarteng was completely unaware that he was going to be sacked, and he learned that he was going to be sacked reading that tweet and the Times live blog.
Steve, one of the really striking things, looking back over all of the political editors we've spoken to, half a century of political history, where we think almost everything that could happen did happen, And yet you're the political editor, right slap bang in the middle of a pandemic.
It was a very challenging time. There were several scoops that the Times broke during that period, including revealing that there was going to be a second lockdown. And there was an incredible amount of dysfunction, an incredible amount of issues in number 10 and problems. And the result of that, what we came out from, was Boris Johnson tried to reset his premiership. He tried to start again. He got rid of Dominic Cummings and he wanted to find a new path forward. He wanted sunlit uplands. And it precipitated the most incredible period in politics of political violence that I think most people would accept for generations. It was in the 2.5 years that I've been political editor, we've had 3 prime ministers, at least 42 ministerial resignations. It's been politics on hyperspeed for 2.5 years.
It's amazing. You've had as many prime ministers in 2.5 years as Phil Webster managed in almost 2 decades, because he had basically John Major, Tony Blair, Gordon Brown.
It's been a period of extraordinary political dysfunction on multiple fronts. And being the political editor at the Times, being able to report on that, and my great predecessor, Francis Elliott, who you've also interviewed when I interviewed for this job, said, the great thing about the Times, Steve, is you get to tell the truth. Now, you and I know Francis is a deeply cynical man on many levels, but he meant it. And it is the great privilege that my job is to give readers a ringside seat on these events without fear or favour and literally just tell them what is happening.
There's a nice symmetry as well, because this series began with Fred Emery, who was the political editor in the late 70s. But before that, he covered Watergate. And your political editorship so far has been dominated in many ways by Partygate. And actually, sometimes we get a bit caught up in the idea that everything that's happening right now is unprecedented and new. And actually, the fall of a president 50 years ago, the fall of a prime minister on your watch.
And it was a kind of the drip-drip nature of Partygate. So when I started as political editor, all the seeds were there. The events, many of these events had already happened, these lockdown breaching parties. And when they started to emerge, the key figures were also in place. So Dominic Cummings had left number 10, had animus against the prime minister, clearly thought he was completely incompetent, a shopping trolley, and the leaks just kept coming and coming.
He doesn't have a plan. He doesn't know how to be prime minister. And we'd only got him in there because we had to solve a certain problem, not because we thought that he was the right person to run the country.
And it became completely unsustainable. And one of the most interesting things from my perspective about covering that period is the total erosion of trust in number 10. So number 10, it relies on trust. It relies on when it says something is not true, that people report that. But because things had happened and it was issuing very firm denials that there had been any parties, that there'd been any issues in number 10 at all, it just became apparent that these were lies, that there were real issues with what was emanating from the building in number 10. And there was almost during that, under Boris Johnson's premiership, a total breakdown in trust between the lobby and number 10.
And it's interesting that, because actually, and lots of people will shout at the radio and they'll say, oh, I don't know why you've ever trusted them, politicians have always lied. But there has been this sort of agreement, this unspoken rule between special advisors and ministers and the press, journalists, that you don't lie. They might obfuscate, they might not return your calls, but you don't tell straightforward lies. And it was quite a breach, wasn't it, in that unwritten rule?
It was a huge breach of that unwritten rule. And for a lot of Boris Johnson's premiership and the aftermath of it, we've been in a debate about what is a lie? What is misleading? Is it intentional? Is it unintentional? Is it knowing? Is it not knowing? But either way, you ended up in a situation where effectively the lines from number 10 were just untenable and unsustainable. And that went right to the top, ultimately, because you had the Prime Minister standing up in the Commons, Boris Johnson, saying that there were no parties and there were no events that had happened in number 10. And these lines turned out to be wrong.
I have been repeatedly assured since these allegations emerged that there was no party and that no COVID rules were broken.
His defence that he wasn't aware of these events and therefore couldn't be held accountable ultimately for them, it didn't wash with the Privileges Committee, as we saw, and he's no longer an MP.
It's extraordinary because it happened so quickly after the 2019 general election. He wins this extraordinary majority. He, I think in an interview with you, said that he was eyeing a decade in Downing Street, and he barely beyond that lasted a year. Do you think that ultimately the seeds were sown, actually just by dint of Boris Johnson's personality, that his ability to survive in a job as pressured and detailed and dramatic as being Prime Minister, he just was never going to survive and do 10 years like a Blair or a Thatcher.
I think one of the issues was the kind of chronic instability under Boris Johnson's government. And there were successive rounds of this. It wasn't just at one point. And what I mean by that is there was constant infighting in number 10. There were different figures and different people who were all trading off. They all thought they had his ear. And then in cabinet, there was constant infighting. And then beyond that, there was infighting between the Prime Minister himself and his Chancellor, Rishi Sunak, who had two very different visions. So the way that he governed and the way he solicited advice was inherently unstable. What I kind of felt looking at it in hindsight was Boris Johnson didn't really have very many loyal people around him that were loyal to him personally, and it was an incredibly fractured and disunited number 10. One of the things I wanted to look at was when Boris Johnson actually quit and the events around number 10 and what was going on, how personal it suddenly got.
Yeah.
So in his dying days, as he was sitting in number 10 and everyone was resigning left, right and centre, Boris Johnson appears to have blamed Michael Gove and gone back to that oldest of the Tory wounds, that oldest of the Brexit psychodramas.
I've realised in the last few days that Boris isn't capable of building that team and providing that unity.
I got this extraordinary briefing from a senior ally of Boris Johnson as everything was falling around him, that it was all that snake Michael Gove's fault. And this caused its own, had its own repercussions. We had, shortly after that, the summer party, which was a Spectator's big event in the Spectator Garden, and it was within days of the resignation of Boris Johnson. And I remember standing there, and there was a guy that worked for Michael Gove called Josh Grimston, and there's a guy that worked for Boris Johnson, his director of communications called Guido Harry, and literally they physically squared up to each other in the garden. The violence, the political violence, nearly ended in fisticuffs in front of me and several other journalists at this very serene, cerebral event. So it was just, there was a kind of undercurrent of violence throughout of it all that never, even in its dying days, was still there.
That's a good one. And in fact, I think at that event, it was the early days of the Tory leadership contest to then replace Boris Johnson. Rishi Sunak was at sort of one end of the garden, glad-handing everyone. Liz Truss at the other. I mean, what an extraordinary leadership contest, basically this time last year, where this sort of disjoint happened even more, where Liz Truss was the darling of the party, but the public never really warmed to her. And so it, and nor actually did her colleagues, and so it played out when she became Prime Minister.
And when she became Prime Minister, I mean, that 49 days in terms of sheer carnage takes some beating. And I want to go back to nearly a year ago to that conference, that Conservative Party conference, because I remember walking in there and literally arrived at conference and was receiving briefings from Truss allies in the most awful foul terms against the people that she thought were trying to remove her, and then likewise on the other side. And it was complete chaos. We had a lunch with Kwasi Kwarteng on the day that he dropped the additional rate of income tax, and he was remarkably calm at this lunch, remarkably calm. Several hours later, he's forced into one of the biggest U-turns that completely destabilised the government. And I also remember going to see Liz Truss at that conference, so sitting there, and by this stage, many acts of political violence have been perpetrated. Grant Shapps, who was very concerned about Liz Truss's regime, was going around with his Samsung phone, which folded out and had a giant spreadsheet.
He got a new phone because it folded out, so it had a bigger screen so he could see the spreadsheet which listed people who might bring down Liz Truss, basically.
Exactly. It was a long list of people that were there, and the threat was very visible. Michael Gove was very publicly trying to undermine her. And so the Tory warfare was all out, and she'd been forced to drop this flagship measure, the 45p rate. And when we saw her in person in her conference suite, she was just remarkably calm. She was remarkably sanguine about it all. And she thought there was a way through. She thought there was a way forward.
The abolition of the 45p tax rate became a distraction from the major parts of our growth plan. That is why we're no longer proceeding with it. I get it, and I have listened.
I remember emerging from it thinking, that is one of the most surreal things I've ever, literally everything is blowing up around you and you're just very serene and very calm about it. And I thought, I could only assume that she was disconnected from the events that were happening directly around her at that point in time, because you walk out into that hotel bar afterwards and it's all there in the open again.
And then, of course, we come back from the party conference. Liz Truss says she's a fighter, not a quitter. And then Kwasi Kwarteng is in America. He's at the IMF. He's told to come home because it's all going a bit wrong. And you, in an act of high political drama, essentially sack Kwasi Kwarteng by tweet.
So, what happened was Kwasi Kwarteng was flying back, as you say, from the IMF, and all was not well. And I picked up a suggestion that was really incendiary, that Liz Truss was about to sack Kwasi Kwarteng. And it's the kind of thing you have to be very careful with. So I did some more checking and I got it confirmed. And then I thought, well, what do I do with this? This is politics happening at hyperspeed. It's not like we wait for newspapers anymore. We have live blogs, we have Twitter. So I thought, let's just get it out there. So we did the tweet and we put it at the top of the live blog on the Times' live blog, and everything just exploded, because at this point in time, Kwasi Kwarteng was completely unaware that he was going to be sacked. And he learned that he was going to be sacked reading that tweet and the Times live blog.
And I actually learned on Twitter, on Steve Swinford's Twitter. So I was in the car on the way to Downing Street, and my special advisor said, "Oh, have you seen this?" And I looked at it and it said, you know, Kwasi Kwarteng has been sacked or will be sacked. I can't remember which tense it was. And I was very much of the view that, oh, well, that's interesting.
And there was an amazing series of photos. There was one when he got into the car at the airport, when he was smiling for the cameras, going to see Liz Truss, going to fix the economy, going to make everything right. And when he got out at number 10, looking very grim-faced. When I say politics is happening at hyperspeed, that is one of the big changes. If you're looking at all of the political editors you've interviewed, we're in this era now where, and particularly that Liz Truss era, things were happening almost minute by minute.
Yeah.
You were getting entire budgets reversed in a matter of hours. You were getting successive cabinet resignations, appointments. And it's just the sheer pace of it that is one of the biggest changes in covering politics.
Do you think that a Liz Truss prime minister would have survived that period if it had been the 1970s? Is there something about the relentlessness of rolling news, social media, live blogs, and actually the fact that the Westminster Village feeds that beast the entire time in perhaps the way they wouldn't have done, because they would have thought, well, you had one deadline at the end of the day. Do you think those sets of economic and political circumstances would have been survivable in a different media era?
No, I don't think they would have been. I think for two reasons. One is the choices that she made. So that offer of £45 billion worth of unfunded tax cuts, which fundamentally destabilised the markets. And secondly, just the sheer number and the profile of people that were opposed to her. So there were so many enemies. It wasn't just factions. This was hundreds of MPs literally ranged against her. As you said, Matt, she had the support of the membership, but a very large chunk of the Conservative Party MPs, the parliamentarians themselves, were opposed to her. And that became totally unstable. So when you get those two things, you've got her choices, you've got these very risky choices on the economy that she took with the consequences, allied with the fact that there were so many people who didn't want her to be prime minister in the first place, and that meant it was totally unsustainable. And that would have been as unsustainable back then as it was now. Now, Twitter, the way we report on things, accelerates all of that. It means that things happen faster, hence it was a 49-day premiership, but all of the seeds of the destruction were there almost from day one.
The fundamentals ultimately remain the same. We should move on to the current prime minister, but even the period between Liz Truss's resignation and Rishi Sunak finally getting the job that he wanted. An extraordinary moment of Boris Johnson attempting a comeback. Clearly, that sort of comeback now would be harder because he's not still an MP. Do you think he was delusional to think he could have come back at that point last October, November?
I think it would have been very hard for him to come back at that point, but it is worth remembering he did still have quite a significant number of MPs backing him. There were Johnson loyalists in the party, so there was space for it. I think that ultimately, if it came down to it, Rishi Sunak would have had the broader support and would have won it, but it would have been a very nasty and very bitter leadership contest. So was it delusional? I don't know about delusional, because there was a potential way of him actually achieving what he set out to do, but it was very unlikely. And the consequences of that bloodshed, we're probably getting close to general election territory at that point, of them ripping themselves to shreds again.
So here we are then. We've got Rishi Sunak as Prime Minister. It's fair to say that the pace, the psychodrama, if you like, of politics has settled down. The conversation now is actually much more about the economy, probably, than it is about personalities. But it's not doing him any good in the polls. How do you find Rishi Sunak as a prime minister to deal with compared to the others?
So his approach to this job. So lots of people have known Rishi Sunak for quite a while. I know him dating back from when he was a relatively junior minister in the Department for Communities. And he was always approachable, and he is friendly and will talk to journalists. But his approach to this job has been one to minimise risks, as you said, to take out the psychodrama, to try to get a grip on the economy and to try to turn things around. And as we sit here today, Matt, we are at effectively a tipping point in his premiership, in that, yes, things are calmer. I would say this is the quietest recess that we've seen since 2014, I think. I was trying to work out how...
Pre-Scottish referendum.
Pre-Scottish referendum, pre-Brexit. So this is a relatively quiet recess. It feels like it used to, but you've still got this thwonking 20-point gap in the polls. And everyone that I'm talking to in the cabinet and the ministers and the Tory MPs are saying he needs to do something. We can't just have this five priorities, which are basically about making everyone's life a little bit less bad or less worse than it is now. He needs to offer a positive vision, and he needs to go out there and do it. And now, Rishi Sunak is naturally cautious, so he's weighing up when is the right time to do that and what that looks like. But I am detecting an impatience among Tory MPs. We've got MPs will be back shortly. And when they come back, the party is going to start getting much more difficult to manage again. And crucially, cabinet is going to start getting much more difficult to manage again.
I have to say, Steve, having worked closely with you in the Times parliamentary office, I've never seen anyone work the phones harder. Quite often I'll be talking to you and suddenly I'll look around, he's on the phone again. He's got just a relentlessness of bashing the phones, basically trying to get every story from every angle. Who, without necessarily naming names, is it the Labour Party? Is it Tory backbenchers? Is it the cabinet? Who's always guaranteed to pick the phone up? How do you hammer the phones to make sure you're getting to, like as you said, getting to as much as you can, the truth of what's going on?
So one of the misconceptions about politics is it's all about the principles. So it's all about the kind of big figures, the leaders, the cabinet ministers. It's not. Westminster is a kind of interconnected spider's web almost of lots of people, and many of them are very small players. People won't know their names, they won't know who they are, and occasionally you find someone and they know everything and they're really interested in it and they know the whole wider picture. And so often some of the very biggest stories that I have broken have come from relative people on the scale that are minnows and would not be considered, that no one knows their names, as I said. But that's the point, that it goes far beyond the principles. The people that know what's going on in the rooms of power and where things are happening are much kind of lower down the food chain than you'd think. And it's a lot of those people that are relatively anonymous that are incredibly useful to me and always have been. And that's not to say that the cabinet ministers and all the other players aren't important, but it's a much broader network than people think.
And looking back over this series then, you know, Fred Emery, the rise of Margaret Thatcher, the fall of Jim Callaghan. We had Julian Haviland and his tussles with Margaret Thatcher and his extraordinary stories about the Queen as well. You know, Peter Riddle in the fall of Thatcher, the Blairite New Labour era dominated by Philip Webster, the coalition over Roland Watson, Brexit, which sort of dominated Francis Elliott's time. Given the drama of the last two or three years of you having the political editor job, would you swap that for any other period in that time?
Absolutely not. As a journalist, like I say, my modus operandi is to put readers in the room where it's happened, and you will not find a more, it may be Brexit, actually, the period after Brexit was on a par, but this, to try to give readers a full 360 view of what's going on in government, which is, I think, what it's all about, this is as good as it gets from that point of view, of trying to just explain to people what's happening and why it's happening.
A pinch me moment in the last 3 years of you being political editor where you just thought, I've really got, as we've been, the phrase I've been using in this series, the sort of front row seat of political history.
So one of the things I wanted to tell you about, one of the most surreal moments that I've had as a reporter, Matt, was during the pandemic. So I remember it really distinctly. It was 2020, and I had been working on a story all day that Matt Hancock was pushing for another lockdown, basically a second lockdown, but Boris Johnson was resisting. And for some reason, the pandemic things always happened on Fridays. And I wanted to give you a little insight into my setup. So I was sitting in the bedroom on my fold-out desk with my laptop, because that's what the pandemic was like. And I was calling around as many people as I could. And something didn't smell right about the story. Something wasn't good, and it just didn't chime correctly. And it got to 6 o'clock, and we have early copy deadlines on a Friday, and the editor started calling me and saying, you need to file your story now, Steve. And I said, I just need a little bit more time. Something's not quite right with the story. I said, no, we're going to go late off stone. You need to file your story. So I said, hang on, John Wither, who was the editor. And then I managed to put in a few more calls, and I discovered that there had been a secret meeting that afternoon between Boris Johnson, the then Prime Minister, and all the most senior cabinet ministers, and they had decided to put the UK into a second lockdown that was going to start the following week. And I sat there and I thought, this is utterly incendiary. And I rang up a few more people, managed to stand it up, managed to crash it into the paper for first edition that evening. And I remember sitting there after doing this, and the adrenaline from that kind of reporting it's quite an extraordinary thing as you're reporting on it. And I was just sitting there in my bedroom on my fold-out desk, on my laptop, and just thinking, this is absolutely extraordinary. We were going down to lockdown. I remember going downstairs and saying to friends and family, so just so you know, everyone, we're going into lockdown. And when the front page came out, when our story came out that evening, the Times was the first to break that story. And it actually accelerated the moves. The government then had to, because it was all true, the government had to bring forward a press conference till Saturday. Boris Johnson did a press conference on Saturday.
Christmas is going to be different this year, but it's my sincere hope and belief that by taking tough action now, we can allow families across the country to be together.
All it was is reporting on what was happening, but at the same time, it's extraordinary sometimes the extent, the kind of influence that reporting can have when you're just literally someone with a phone at a computer on a fold-out desk. And a lot of the pandemic was like that. We were finding out about things that would affect the lives of millions and millions of people very significantly, just literally on our own in our bedrooms doing our reporting because we couldn't go into work. And it really has stuck with me as one of the most surreal moments of my career.
You've been political for 3 years. A hell of a lot's happened in that time. What do you think politics looks like in 3 years' time?
I think the economy is still dominant. I think that whoever wins this election is probably going to be faced with an issue where they actually have to raise taxes. They're not going to say that publicly now. They'll all go into the election promising to cut taxes. But it's going to be difficult. And the big question for whoever wins it is, can they get economic growth going? Can they get us out of this? And that's what a lot of politics actually comes down to. It does always come down to the economy. It's at the root of everything. Yes, there are good choices. There are bad choices. There are good fiscal choices. There are bad fiscal choices. But are people feeling, it's the oldest question in the world, Matt.
Yeah.
Are you feeling better off? You've got more money in your pockets. And the concern I've got looking at this is I'm not sure that given the tectonic economic plates involved, it's going to be very difficult to get growth going. And it's going to be a very difficult government, whoever wins it.
Well, Stephen Swinford, current political editor of The Times, and following in the footsteps of some greats that we've heard from over the last few days. Thanks very much for joining us on Times, Eddie.
Absolute pleasure, Matt.
And that's all we've got time for on today's episode. Don't forget, if you've missed any of the episodes of The Political Editor, just look back on your podcast feed. There are 7 episodes altogether, and they're all just brilliant. Like The Crown, but for politics, as Stig Abel described them. But for now, for me, Matt Jolly, it's goodbye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend. Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.